It's a great pleasure today to have Fedor Simković, who accepted to give this talk. Thank you, Fedor.
Thanks for having me.
Let me say a few words about Fedor. Fedor is a postdoc here at the Collège de France and at CPHT, École Polytechnique. And he has really been one of the leaders driving the field of diagrammatic Monte Carlo methods for fermionic systems, and in particular the Hubbard model, with a very nice recent work pushing the method in different directions. So I think in his talk he's going to give us an overview of what this method is about, and also physical applications to the Hubbard model. Fedor did his undergraduate studies in Germany at the University of Tübingen, which is not only known for physics but also for theology. Although he did follow a physics course.
I did no theology courses, to my knowledge.
He's a very multicultural and multilingual individual. Also in physics, he has touched upon other topics than condensed matter physics, having done some experiments on neutrino physics at some points in his career. Then he moved, after his undergrad at Tübingen, he moved to King's College London, where he did a PhD with Evgeny Kozik and started working on diagrammatic Monte Carlo with a very nice series of papers, and he's now in Paris. So thank you very much, Fedor, for giving this lecture, and the floor is yours.
First of all, thanks a lot for having me. It's nice to actually, well, first of all, to give a talk here, but to give a talk in person to actual real people, even though I feel like I'm a bit rusty and talking to my computer, giving presentations has become the new norm, but I'll give my best. Okay, so as Antoine said, my talk will be on the fermionic Hubbard model and from a perspective of diagrammatic Monte Carlo, which is a method which has been recently, I would say, blossoming, and there's a lot of nice new results that that have been obtained. And first, I would like to, I'd like to thank my collaborators, amongst which you can find in the center Antoine Georges, and also Michel Ferrero, in whose group I am a postdoc here in Paris, and also PhD in his group, Renaud Garriot. Also, I would like to acknowledge my former supervisor, Evgeny Kozik, and his group in London. And we've been very closely collaborating on diagrammatic Monte Carlo sort of topics with Riccardo Rossi, who is currently at EPFL in Lausanne, and there's many others. Okay, so, of course, this talk, as the title says, will be concentrated on the fermionic Hubbard model, which, luckily, you have been seeing lectures on from Antoine for the last couple of weeks. And just a quick reminder, we have a hopping term here, which is T. We have an on-site interaction term when you have two fermions of spin up and down on the same side, which is U. And also in this talk, we will have another term added to the Hamiltonian, which is next nearest neighbor hopping, which is called T prime. Okay, which is normally the sort of first additional term that one adds to the Hubbard-Hamiltonian to make it a bit more complex, and also a bit more related to cuprates, where in cuprates there is this term is non-zero. Okay, so you might ask, okay, where do we stand on the Fermi-Hubbard model? We can solve it analytically, only in zero dimensions though. In one dimensions there is semi-analytic techniques such as beta-ansatz, and you've been hearing a whole seminar from Thierry Jamarqui last week about 1D systems with Hubbard interaction. And as I've also learned, things are not even simple in that particular case. And there is a lot of interesting things going on, especially when you're trying to look at finite temperature and correlation functions. Then, as Antoine is sitting here, it would be wrong to not mention that dynamic mean field theory actually becomes exact in the limit of infinite dimensions. And then in between, we have two and three dimensions, and there things start getting a bit dicey. Mainly, we have a variety of ground state methods which work at temperature zero. And there, there's a lot of ongoing developments, and mainly the competition between different phases in the ground state in terms of the energetics is very, very close, and that's the reason why the sort of phase diagram, even in the ground state, hasn't been fully established yet. And in two and three dimensions at a finite temperature, you can do, for example, exact diagonalization, but only up to 16 sites in the Hubbard model because of the fast-growing Hilbert space, as Antoine was telling you a week ago. Then there are methods which have to resolve to uncontrolled approximations. So you make an approximation, but you don't know how big the terms were that you had to throw out. Other other methods might have a way of being approximated controllably, but pretty much all of them have to rely on the fact that they can only be computed for finite size systems, and to reach the thermodynamic limit is actually, for many of these methods, a rather hard task, especially when one starts to dope due to the fermionic sign problem. And so in this talk, I'll be talking about a bit of a complementary method, which is called diagrammatic Monte Carlo. And as I'll show you, this method works directly in the thermodynamic limit, so we can directly tackle infinite size systems. And provided we can converge this method, and I'll explain what this means in a couple slides, this this technique actually becomes numerically exact. And so I've borrowed this phase diagram from a recent publication by Emmanuel Gu and co-authors, where they try to give an overview. It's actually a very nice publication. They try to give an overview of what is known in the Fermi-Hubbard model. And what they do here is they deliberately constructed two sort of invented phase diagrams, one in the ground state and one at finite temperature. And as you can tell, they don't really match, and that's on purpose. And so, as Antoine explained to you, at finite temperature, you can have an anti-ferromagnetic phase, pseudogap, stranger metal, where resistivity is linear, superconducting dome, and Fermi liquid regime at high doping. And in the ground state, I mean, from the publications that we have, one finds a slightly sort of different set of phases. One, like notably, one finds stripe order with different stripe lengths. And one can also find phase separation between different spatial phase separation between different phases, also antiferromagnetism and D-wave superconductivity. And so I think the big task in trying to understand the Hubbard model is trying to glue somehow or marry this finite temperature phase diagram together with this ground state phase diagram here, or their real equivalents. And so I think diagrammatic Monte Carlo currently is sort of pushing, at least on the numerically exact side, this boundary in terms of temperature slowly but surely down to lower temperatures and to higher values of interaction. And that's what today's talk will be about. Okay, so just a quick outline. So I'll start by a brief and swift introduction to diagrammatic Monte Carlo, and I'll try to go quickly as to leave myself enough time to actually show you some physical results in the Hubbard model. And then I'll talk about diagrammatic Monte Carlo results in the Hubbard model. In the weak coupling regime, I'll show you the phase diagram in terms of superfluid ground states, so superconductivity. I will briefly mention the nail transition in 3D, which is something Antoine has shown a couple minutes ago, and talk about the metal to insulator crossover in 2D, both at half filling. And then the last two topics, provided I have not wasted all of my time, will be talking about what happens if we start from the half-filled Hubbard model in 2D and either start adding next nearest neighbor hopping, in this case, or start doping the system. And in particular, we're interested in a 1-8 doping where there's been a lot of work done, especially at zero temperature. Okay, right, so introduction to diagrammatic Monte Carlo. So we have here the Fermi-Hubbard model Hamiltonian, and one can also equally rewrite the corresponding action for this model, which will consist of a quadratic term and a quartic term here, corresponding, of course, to the quadratic and quartic terms of the Hamiltonian representation here. And what we can do is, if we want to compute some quantity, such as, for example, the Gram partition function, we can expand in terms of the interacting part of the action, and we can write, so here we've basically introduced the Taylor expansion of this interacting part, and we can write this as a power series in powers of u with some Zn, where Zn is this mean here, which is computed with the quadratic action. And so to be able to treat such a mean, one knows that there is the Wick theorem, which can actually transform such a mean into a determinant of what I call here this double Z, which is a matrix of size n by n, where here n is the expansion order, and each entry of this matrix that we will take the determinant of is a bare Green's function. Now, so that's the repetition, but now, so what we want to do is we want to compute this calligraphic Z of n as we had defined it previously, and so here we write out the interacting part of the action. And we can actually split it into two parts, one for spin up, one for spin down. And each of those will correspond to one determinant of a matrix, one for spin up and one for spin down. Now, we can call the product of these two determinants this bold Z. And we can equally introduce sort of a Feynman diagrammatic like graphical notation in terms of building blocks, and our building blocks here will be the bare Green's functions that we have inside of these matrices, and we'll represent the interaction vertex U here such that you have two lines coming in and two lines going out, two Green's functions in and out, one of each spin species up and down. We will represent these as U. And so, in practice, what this means is that we have a sort of a set of n vertices in real space and imaginary time, so we're in the Matsubara formalism, and we can compute the corresponding bold Z sort of object also graphically. And so at zeroth order, what this means is that what we have to do is we have to compute two determinants of empty matrices, which is just one by definition. But then at first order, you get one sort of self loop for the up Green function. So that's a one by one matrix, and the same for a down spin matrix. And when you multiply these, you actually get the first order contribution to the partition function in terms of Feynman diagrams. And you can go on, you can do this sort of with two vertices at second order, and for two vertices you have now two by two matrices which you have to multiply, and as you can see here, you generate again all of the correct Feynman diagrams that correspond to the partition function. And of course you can go on to higher orders. Now if we want to compute something which sort of like an observable correlator of interest, like for example the Green's function, we could write it in terms of the ratio of these two integrals. On the bottom you see this is the integral for Z as we had defined it earlier, and on the top you will have two additional Grassmann terms here, and we'll call this integral on the top, we'll call it A of spin up. And we can define again A of spin up in terms of a power series the same way we've done it for the partition function. And we can expand it using the Wick's theorem as before, then take it apart into two pieces, one for spin up and one for spin down. And now we see that here one of the two has two extra terms, which means that we'll have two matrices, one being double Z and one being double A. And the double A will have one extra row and column, which corresponds to these external Grassmann numbers. And graphically, again, we can think of this as Feynman diagrams. You can do at first order, it's actually just the bare Green's function, this object A at zeroth order. At first order, you have to multiply a 2x2 matrix by a 1x1, which you see generates here these two terms. And you can also go second order, and then you get you multiply a 3x3 matrix by a 2x2, and once you do the graphical math, you end up with these 12 terms. And what you see here in terms of these terms is that some of them have Feynman diagrams which are fully connected, and some of them have connected parts, and we define connectedness with respect to the in and out vertices, and some disconnected parts which resemble the diagrams that we had for the partition function. Now, what is called determinant or diagrammatic Monte Carlo, which is a bit of a slightly different technique, even though it has a similar name, or also equivalently known as CTN, so continuous time quantum Monte Carlo, used to solve impurities within the context of DMFT. So what we can do here is we can actually compute A, compute Z, and take the ratio of these two power series. And both A and Z are entire functions, so we can actually they're gonna converge if we can compute enough orders of the expansion, which normally we can. And so this sort of reminds you of what is called the link cluster theorem. Graphically, I can take A apart into all of the connected parts multiplied by all of the partition function type diagrams, and sort of take them out into separate bracket and then cancel them with the denominator, which leaves me with only connected diagrams, which is what you're supposed to get for the Green's function. Now, this is all nice, but the problem with this particular approach is that if you start increasing the system size, you'll see that basically both A and Z are going to start to diverge as this power, as you approach the thermodynamic limit, and also the average perturbation order is going to diverge as well. And this is easily seen in the following way. So I've just drawn here a random diagram of sixth order, which has a connected part here and a few disconnected parts. And in terms of the maths, if you compute the sort of the value or the weight of this diagram for particular vertices 1 to 6, and you compute the weight for this configuration where I've simply moved further away in here, it's real space, but it could be also in time, the disconnected parts, the weight will be exactly the same. And so you see that as I scale my system, this integral over all possible configurations is going to start to grow. So that's just a graphical way of saying the same thing. Okay, and so the alternative that came in terms of how to compute this Green's function is due to Nikolai Prokofiev and Boris Svistonov in the late 90s. And what they said is, okay, look, my Green's function, actually, I can express it itself in terms of a power series, and why don't I just go and sample directly the power series for G instead of taking the ratio? And this is here the series of just connected diagrams for the Green's function, and the way, here's the series again, and the way this was done back in the day was that you had a Monte Carlo procedure where at each Monte Carlo step, you either change the topology or change the diagram order or change some external or internal parameters. In terms of internal parameters would be, for example, the positions and times of these internal vertices. And then you can devise a metropolis scheme which samples these diagrams one by one. And there's been a lot of nice results produced by this method. The only issue is that as you go to higher and higher expansion order, number of these diagrams at each order grows factorially. And so all of a sudden, say at a high order, you're left with a factorial number of diagrams which all can come with different signs, which end up canceling to a value which can be a lot smaller than each individual diagram. And this forcibly generates what is called the fermionic sign problem. And so an alternative that has been invented a couple years ago by Riccardo Rossi was it's called the connected determinant diagrammatic Monte Carlo, CDET. And the idea is that we can rewrite all of these calligraphic A, Z, and Gs in terms of functions of sets of vertices. So here, x1 to xn are the vertices, and this is a set of or a subset. Here written again. So S is this set of vertices, and then what we can do is we can actually introduce a recursive formula which relates G to A and Z in such a way that it, for each set of so for each G of a particular set, I can start from the A, the same A of the same of that set, and from it remove the sum of all connected and disconnected parts, connected being G and disconnected Z. And once I do that, I actually end up only with connected diagrams. And I can do this recursively going in the order of the set. And so a quick show of how this works is, so I can, for example, I can take the zeroth order Green's function, which is just the same as A, so just a bare propagator. At the first order, I can take A, which is these two diagrams, and then I can subtract from it the first order Green's function here multiplied by, the zeroth order Green's function multiplied by the first order partition function, which is this diagram. And you see that this exactly cancels out the one disconnected diagram that I had generated in A, and I end up with having only a connected diagram. And of course, you can also do this for higher order Green's functions. Okay, and then the Monte Carlo procedure is then what one has to do is one has to compute all determinants corresponding to all sets or subsets of n vertices, and then one has to recursively subtract all the disconnected diagrams from the sums, which is done by the formula as I've explained here, and then what is the Monte Carlo actually samples directly with the weight of G. Of X, so with of the Green's function, which only contains connected diagrams. And one can show that actually both of these steps can be performed with an exponential number of computational steps. I'm not going to go into detail, but basically, so we're summing now a factorial number of diagrams in exponential time, which is giving us an advantage. And the advantage is such that as whilst for conventional diagrammatic Monte Carlo in the Prokofiev-Swistonov sort of way, we're able to get 6 to 7 expansion orders here, for CDET it's more like 10 to 12. Okay, and so once you have your series computed by Monte Carlo, of course you need to evaluate the series, and the evaluation of the series depends on what value of U, of course, you're trying to evaluate it. And you can look at a function in terms of, for example, here it's the imaginary part of the self-energy for the Hubbard atom, and you can also compute it for, you can compute it analytically, and you can compute it also for complex values of U, which means that you can actually draw the complex plane of this function in terms of the real part of U and the imaginary part of U. And you see here there is a singularity in the complex plane which will define what is called the convergence radius. And so if I'm trying to evaluate my series within this convergence radius, I'll get something which is nicely convergent. But as I'm being more and more ambitious and I'm trying to, for example, evaluate my series on the convergence radius, I get something which is highly oscillatory. And if I'm outside of the convergence radius, I get a series which diverges. Now, this is not the end of the world, though, because we actually have techniques to treat even divergent series. One of them is, for example, conformal maps. I'm going to play a small video where we can map this complex plane onto a unit disk with some tuning parameter A here, and as I change A, I can actually move my poles around in this complex disk and therefore change the radius of convergence. And as you just saw, as soon as I moved all of my poles out of the radius where I was trying to evaluate my function, for a brief moment here, you had a partial sum of this power series, which was actually convergent. Another way of treating this, and I'm going to play another video, is to sort of approximate this power series in terms of the ratio of two other power series. This is called Padé approximants. And as I increase the number of, the order of these two series, which is NP and Q, given here, you saw that even though the complex plane might not really resemble the original one, but the approximate Padé result is actually starting to converge towards the right result here, which also works. Okay. And if you wonder what the complex plane looks like for more, when you add more sides to your Hubbard atom, so here's Hubbard chains, you see that you get sort of these strings of singularities in the complex plane, which multiply as you add further sides. Okay, another idea which I'm going to go very, very quickly on is you can actually introduce a shift to your action in terms of this alpha, and then when you do your diagrams, this means that you have to compensate for changing basically your Baer-Greens function. You have to compensate by introducing new diagrams which have such alpha insertions I've marked with a red X. And then your Green's function becomes a bit more complicated, but what you can see is that actually one can tune this alpha such that for each diagram which has a self-loop Hartree insertion, you can also have an alpha insertion, and the two can cancel each other out perfectly. So this is a way of removing all sorts of tadpole insertions. But you can also, for example, go back to your Hubbard atom and look at what happens in the complex plane if I just, for example, start tuning this alpha parameter. And as you can see, I'm starting to change alpha, and my poles, again, are moving, and some of them are moving out of my radius where I'm trying to evaluate. And as soon as the last pole exits, you see my series has become nicely convergent. And you know, if I keep pushing my luck, at some point, some other poles might come back to haunt me. Okay. Yeah, well, that's a long video. Okay, and something which is very recent is that what we've actually figured out how to do efficiently within the CDET sort of formalism is to, instead of computing power series just in terms of these AK coefficients and powers of U, we can actually compute double series in terms of U and alpha. And what this allows us to do is that we can actually decide what we want alpha to be a posteriori. So we first compute coefficients, and after we have our series, we say, okay, why don't we set alpha to this or that? In particular, what we can do is we can actually set alpha such that our density for the series will not change. So what we're getting is a series which is at fixed density, and for each U, we're getting the right physical answer if we can converge. And you see, the series can have a lot nicer convergence properties in terms of the, say, partial sum. So for example, this is the same series for fixed chemical potential, which is if alpha is zero, and this is for fixed density, where you see it's a lot nicer convergent. And also we can go back to our Hubbard chains, which is why I introduced them, and think of the poles in the complex plane. And for example, this is, again, the same idea of the complex plane at fixed chemical potential, where you see a lot of poles appearing close to the real axis and making our radius of convergence smaller, whilst at fixed density you're getting something which is a lot better behaved. Okay, that was a very quick introduction to diagrammatic Monte Carlo. Feel free to... Do you have any questions right now? I think this would be a good moment to... In that case... Yes.
Mm-hmm. You could extend to other fixed something, right?
Yes.
In principle.
Yes, we
other
could.
Observable.
Yes, we. So, I mean, we have a function alpha of u, and we have full freedom of deciding what it wants to be. And if we find some equi line of some observable, of course, we can do that. Another example of what one in principle could do, but we haven't done, is we could fix, for example, magnetization.
Exactly.
That would be one option, which is something we haven't done yet, but it's definitely on the menu. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, great. In that case, so I'm going to go on to show you some results for the Fermi-Hubbard model. And I have put here four parameters: the temperature, this interaction value U, the density, and the nearest neighbor hopping, which, well, these three are expressed in units of hopping t, which will not appear in sort of in terms of parameters, which is always set to 1. And you see, this is 4 parameters, and I am barely good enough to draw things in 2D, not to talk about 3D. So what we'll be doing in a lot of what I'll show now is actually take cuts where we fix one or multiple of these quantities. And so what we want to start with, and of course this is what the Hubbard model is famous for, it's its relation to cuprates and to the superconducting physics that is supposed to appear. And you know, one could ask the first question, okay, is there any superfluid ground state in the Hubbard model? And the answer you'll see in one slide is yes. And then the questions are, if yes, how big is the critical temperature? What's the region where this actually happens, and where that's really the sort of energetically lowest phase? You know, there can be competing magnetic instabilities, for example. And you know, it's also a question of what the nature of this pairing of the superfluid phase is. And so here, what I show is one can start in the Fermi liquid regime at high enough temperatures. You're always, in something which at least resembles a Fermi liquid regime. And as you decrease temperature, you will have a Cooper instability develop. And diagrammatically, you can actually capture this instability by writing something that is called the Beta-Cell-Peter equation, where you have a full vertex which contains all diagrams such that you have 2 particles coming in and 2 particles coming out. And you can write it as all of the diagrams which are 2 particle irreducible, which means that you cannot cut those diagrams by removing 2 Green's functions. And plus, so you'll have a 2 particle reducible piece here, and you'll have a piece which is 2 particle reducible, where you see that is actually the irreducible part glued to the full vertex with 2 Green's functions. And this thing, as you decrease temperature, is actually going to diverge logarithmically. And so what one can do is you can compute this gamma PP vertex by diagrammatic Monte Carlo. Here I've shown, in terms of the Baer expansion, the first couple of diagrams that actually contribute to gamma PP. And importantly, if you, for example, take the limit of U going to 0, all you need to do is you need to compute this one single second order diagram. And then you can think of this as a matrix equation, and then you can solve for P and diagonalize, and then what you'll get is of course different eigenvalues, and you can look at them in terms of temperature and how they evolve and see which one the leading is. And as soon as one of these eigenvalues hits the value of 1, you actually have a phase transition. And of course, this is something that Antoine was showing you last week. You can also you can compute the corresponding eigenvectors and project them onto the square Brillouin zone of the 2D Fermi-Hubbard model here in this particular case. And then you can count the number of nodes as you go around the center and also their position. Depending on that, you will have different superfluid phases corresponding to different parts of the D4 point symmetry group, so different irreducible representations here. And so you this is S-wave, DXY, DX squared minus Y squared, which is probably the most famous one, but you can also have here P-wave, and you can have higher order harmonics for each one of them. And of course, you might wonder, why am I showing you these psychedelic phases here? Well, turns out if you go to the weak coupling limit, many of them actually do occur. And so this is, you have density and T prime here in the limit of U going to 0. So really just you compute the second order diagram, and you get a huge chunk here in the middle, which is this cyan blue, which is dx squared minus y squared, which is what you would expect if you're trying to relate the Hubbard model to cuprates. But you also find a lot of other stuff. Notably, you find dxy. So dxy you've got here. So it still has the same number of nodes, but it's turned around by 45 degrees. And you can also find p6 wave. So this has not 4, but where is it? but six nodes, and so on, so on. And you see as you go to further doping, and as you increase T prime, you're slowly but surely ending up in a zoo of different superfluid phases. Luck? Yeah.
Just a couple of questions on this.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say second order in U, what you mean is you calculate the irreducible vertex to second order.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But the F is of course still.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So your gamma PP is just one diagram. That's the.
But F is a
yes.
Chain. Okay. And here we see that the round parfiling one is completely dominated by x squared minus y squared. Right?
Yes, absolutely.
In line with what we would guess perhaps from the small d.
Absolutely, yeah. And you see that this holds true as you add T prime, because for example for cuprates, depending on which compound and depending on which numerical calculation has extracted T prime, but sort of the consensus is that T prime is somewhere between 0.2 and 0.4. I mean, this is actually all minus 0.2, 0.4. So again, in the region where you would want to relate the Hubbard model to cuprates, you would actually find dx squared minus y squared. But of course, this is u going to zero, which you know is not exactly the cuprates sort of u, which would be more like between 6 and 12. Okay. But so what is nice is that actually now what we can do is we can take slices in terms of T prime. So here it is. So this is T prime 0, 0.1, 0.2, and 0.3. And one can do slices in terms of changing density, but now actually going to higher U. So this is a real diagrammatic Monte Carlo calculation done with a Bode G series, which I will not have time to explain. But basically, this is the sort of old school diagrammatic Monte Carlo of Prokofiev and Swistunov, the computed up to 7 expansion orders. And what one sees is that actually this dx squared minus y squared phase, as you see here, still stays stable even if you start adding u to the mix and increasing it and around it. It becomes, let's say, the whole zoo is mostly gone, and what you have is at smaller t primes, this transitions into a dxy phase, and if you go to higher t prime in the whole doped region, you actually still have a stable p6 phase, so 6 nodes. Okay.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Keep going.
So, two questions again here. First, what is this dark shaded triangular cone?
Dark shaded triangular cone.
I don't know. I mean, there's this.
Yes. Actually, very good. I was going to answer this question in the next slide, but.
But
I should have started here, which is perfect. So, thanks for reminding me. Yes, what is the dark shaded triangular cone? Everywhere around this dark shaded triangular cone, our diagrammatic calculations are actually fully converged. So we get a result, it's converged, we can claim an error bar, and that's it. Inside of this cone, the convergence of our series is a lot worse, and given only 7 orders, we can actually, especially as we're approaching sort of half filling, or here, this is half filling, and these dashed red lines are what is called Van Hove densities, where you have a density of states which diverges, and you have some partial nesting at a couple of points. And as you approach these lines, actually your convergence becomes a lot worse. And the reason why your convergence becomes a lot worse is because the object we're computing is gamma in the particle-particle channel. But now imagine there is a competing instability forming in the magnetic particle hole channel. That's actually going to ruin the convergence of our series. And this is the next slide, and this is what we actually observe. So these are some cuts which start at lower doping and start approaching what is here at T prime 0.3, the Van Hove line. And you see that as I'm approaching this line, first of all, my leading eigenvalue starts to become larger and larger, which sort of hints the breakdown of this BCS theory that I've started from. And also you see, if you look at the series as 1 over the order, as I get closer and closer to half filling, or also to this Van Hove line, already here at density 0.72, it's really borderline, and we can maybe claim something with a huge error bar. But it, for example, 20% doping, so density 0.8, it's completely lost, and we cannot do anything with this series. And so I wanted to start from superconductivity, but now you see, okay, as we approach half-filling, there is actually also a magnetic sort of competing order forming, and next thing I want to tackle is actually the magnetic order, and the best place to start is half-filling, because there it's sort of, well, for a lot of methods, it's easier to access because there is particle-hole symmetry, so your fermionic sign problem either disappears or becomes manageable for a lot of numerical techniques. And also, I wanted to start in 3D because in 3D, what you actually have is a finite temperature phase transition, as Antoine has shown an hour ago, from a normal state to an anti-ferromagnetic insulator. And actually, this has been mapped out by a lot of different numerical techniques. And so you see here there is this paramagnetic regime, and okay, there are some discrepancies in terms of the numbers, but here you can clearly see that everyone finds a sort of antiferromagnetic dome. And this is something that we're currently also thinking about. Here are some results from my former group in London that are in preparation, so this is unpublished, where one can start from the normal phase and actually knowing that the 3D Hubbard model is of the 3D Heisenberg universality class means we also know the critical exponents, and we can then fit the asymptotics of our series to actually compute sort of the critical temperature or critical U in this particular case. We can also do something else. We can devise diagrammatic expansions directly inside of the superfluid. Directly inside of the magnetic phase, so in this antiferromagnetic phase here, and then we can compute the diagrammatic expansion in order to get the power series for the magnetization, as is shown here, and we can actually, so this is a result where we start, we expand around the magnetic state, and we start at a finite magnetization, but we end up actually at zero magnetization. And so we're able to really, really capture where our system goes from magnetized to non-magnetized, and then we can actually even find a fit to extract a critical exponent here in this particular case, beta, from our diagrammatic Monte Carlo numerical calculations, which is, again, it's in agreement with the Heisenberg universality class. So that was 3D, very briefly. In 2D, the situation becomes a bit different. And in particular, here this is a sort of not real but tentative phase diagram from a recent publication, where the different regimes of the 2D Hallfield Hubbard model are mapped out. And the first thing to notice is that actually, due to the Merman-Wagner theorem, long-range or magnetic orders forbidden at any finite temperature, and therefore you only get an anti-ferromagnet in the ground state at T equals zero. And one can also start from high temperature. Here, there is a region where thermal fluctuations destroy the coherence of the quasi-particles, and then one can slowly reduce temperature, and we actually get, the longevity of those quasi-particles increases, and we have something which we could call a metallic regime. And then as we decrease temperature further, what happens is that there is no magnetic order or transition, but nevertheless you get antiferromagnetic correlations which start to grow exponentially, and you first go through a regime of what would be called a pseudo-gap, where you have a momentum-selective behavior at the node and the antinode, as Antoine has defined before. So here, this is the Fermi surface, which is nested at half-filling. So that's the Fermi surface. That's the node and the antinode, just to remind you what it was. And so, as you decrease, your antiferromagnetic fluctuations start to grow. Your coherence of the quasi-particles decreases again, and you end up in having something like an insulator. And actually, all of these regimes can be what turns out can be mapped out pretty well by looking at the imaginary part of the self-energy at these two points, the node and the antinode. And depending on the slope of the two, as from the first two Matsubara frequencies, that, I mean, if it's upward slope or downward slope, you can actually see in which, well, it's a proxy for in which regime you are, and this is how it changes as you decrease temperature. And so with diagrammatic Monte Carlo, we've actually mapped out this whole phase diagram, I mean, for the first time in a controlled manner. You can see this, again, this sort of more metallic regime and then insulating. So you see it's the shape of how what it actually looks like is slightly different to the previous slide. And you also see here, for example, the momentum selective self-energy behavior, where this is delta sigma, meaning the difference between the first and the zero from the first Matsubara frequencies. And you see it first changes slope at the antinode, and then slowly grows to change slope everywhere along the Fermi surface. And you can actually also map out these crossovers from different quantities. I don't think I have very much time to go into it, but you can look at the spin and charge correlation functions. You can also look at the kinetic and potential energies. And here, this is another work where we've actually tried to map out these all of these crossovers in terms of these quantities. Okay. And finally, it should also be said that even though you could say it's weak coupling and half-filling, so it should be easy for most numerical techniques because they don't suffer from the fermionic sign problem, or at least not very badly. What we've done in a work which was spearheaded by Antoine himself and Thomas Schaeffer, who is a former postdoc from our group, we've taken, I think, 15, 17, I don't even remember, it's a very big number, I think 15 different numerical methods, and we tried to see how well they can actually capture all of these different regimes at half-filling in the fermionic Hubbard model in 2D. And so here's, for example, the diagrammatic Monte Carlo result, which was taken as a benchmark alongside DQMC. And you see there is a very good agreement between the two. And then there's been a lot of other methods, which I think Antoine is maybe going to touch upon in a week or two. And you see that actually, even though this is half-filling, a lot of the methods are not were not able to actually reliably capture all of these regimes. Okay. So now we go into sort of unknown territory. What I'm going to show from here are unpublished results. So if anything changes or anything is wrong, I want on record to have said that it's all preliminary, so you cannot grill me over it. And so what we're going to do is first we're going to start from half-filling, and we're going to keep at half-filling, but we're going to start tuning T prime, so the nearest neighbor hopping. And the question is, I mean, what we're doing now is we're losing particle hole symmetry and Fermi surface nesting that we had at half-filling without T prime. And the question is, do these strong magnetic correlations survive, and how is the Fermi surface affected? And so first we can answer, the first question about magnetic correlations here, this is, for example, T prime 0.1, but the story is sort of like this everywhere. As I increase my U, you see that my spin susceptibility or spin correlator starts growing around pi, same as it would at half filling. And you can set a threshold, say like 10, and see at what U you actually reach this critical spin correlation function. And as you move away from half-filling, it increases, the U increases slightly, but not significantly. And still, you see, even for T prime 0.3, these magnetic correlations actually do become strong and grow quickly. Now, here's a little video that I'll show you of what happens to sort of the one particle properties, and in particular the self-energy. So I'm showing here the real and imaginary part of the self-energy. Here, this will be the criterion that I had of delta sigma, so the difference between the first two frequencies of the imaginary part of the self-energy. And here you also have the spectral function, the quasiparticle density and quasiparticle velocity. And so now I'm going to play a video where this is the beauty of having a series which we can actually evaluate at all different values of u. And you see, as I'm increasing u, slowly the situation is changing. And I deliberately didn't comment on what happened because, first of all, I cannot speak that quickly. But second of all, I have a slide for that. So let's analyze what we just saw in terms of sort of a line of u interaction starting at some value. So between u27 and 3.2, what actually happens is you have antiferromagnetic correlations which develop and become big. So already here, they're actually very, very big. Then what you see is that the spectral function actually starts broadening, and you get something which looks like a Fermi, like a formation of Fermi arcs. If you go even to even higher values of u, you see that your Fermi surface starts deforming. So we go from something which was on. So this is what I should have said and didn't say from the start, is this is the upper quarter of the Brillouin zone, of course, for all quantities. So you need to think the whole thing would be this quarter times 4 and mirrored over 0. And so you see that you go from something which is more on the sort of looks like the electron doped Fermi surface, and as it deforms, it's actually trying to become again the half filled Fermi surface, so it's trying to nest. And also in terms of our criterion for the self-energy, we see that we start off by something which is behaving metallic along the Fermi surface, but as you increase u, you have momentum differentiation, same as Hall-Filling. You start growing a sort of insulating-like behavior around the antinode, and if you go to high enough u, you actually end up having sort of a negative slope all around the Fermi surface. And finally, if you go to rather, well, for us, rather high u's, what happens is the self-energy becomes rather localized around these points close to the antinode or at the antinode. What this has as a consequence is that actually you get a suppression of the spectral function around the antinode, and something which we get a formation of something which we could call ghost bands, which starts to appear here. Okay, so that's what happens if you take and tune T prime. And the other thing that one can do, well, there's a lot of things that one can do, but the other thing that we have done is to instead actually fix T prime and now start doping the system. So we start from Hall-Filling, and instead of going into the direction of T prime, we go into the direction of doping. And so here again, we can ask some questions. Specifically, there's been a lot of work done at 1.8 doping, so density 0.875, is shown here. And this is, for example, a result by a method called DQMC, which could reach u equals 6 at relatively high temperatures of 0.22, and they can only, because of the nature of the method, they can only operate on sort of finite strips in terms of the system size. And what you see here is actually the staggered staggered spin susceptibility, staggered in the sense that every other side actually has a negative prefactor. So if everything was positive and everything was blue, that would mean that you would have an antiferromagnet. And so what you see here is that you actually start having this sort of vertical stripe-like pattern which forms, and it forms independent on which T prime you actually take. Well, the only thing that changes is sort of the period. And so you get something which is antiferromagnetic for this piece, and then you get a domain wall, and then you sort of turn around and you have again something which is antiferromagnetic but with opposite prefactor. And this is here what I'm showing is actually a recent publication from Sandro Sorella, who is using variational quantum Monte Carlo in the ground state, and he has analyzed u equals 8, which has been largely scrutinized by all sorts of methods for t equals 0. And what he finds at 1-8 doping is actually he finds this this vertical stripe order in this particular case, which has a length of 8 sides. So this is the 8 here, and you see here if you count the number of sides in the case of the finite temperature result, it sort of it matches relatively well. And so if you actually this is in real space, but if you Fourier transform this to momentum space, this would actually mean that you would have a peak at a momentum which would be q pi, where q is some number between 0 and pi, in order to generate these vertical stripe patterns. And so here are some diagrammatic Monte Carlo results where we've looked at the spin correlation function as a function of u. This is for different densities, and you see one thing that is already interesting is that as we dope the system, our magnetic correlations decrease, but they seem to always have a peak around u equals between 4 and 5, and this peak stays relatively stable no matter what, well, up to 30% doping. Maybe not here, but like for a very long time you get a peak that is very stable. And if we look at 1-8 doping and actually change the temperature, we see that as we are lowering the temperature, of course the peak increases, but its position doesn't move very much. And for all of the temperatures that we can actually reach, if you try to compute the corresponding correlation length, it's actually of the size of 1, so it's relatively small at 1-8 doping. So this is a regime where you have some correlations, they are maximum at around u equals 5, but they're not very strong, or very long-ranged. And what we can also see is we can look at what I was saying before is the Fourier transform of this spin susceptibility that we're looking at a couple of slides ago, and from here you can actually tell where this vector we find a peak, and at high temperatures we see that this vector is pi in all cases, even if I go to larger u. But as I decrease my temperature, I start going from something which is peaked around pi to something being peaked at a vector q pi in this particular case. And this q actually starts going away from pi. And if I go to even lower temperature, I actually see that I have a transition from something peaked around q pi to something peaked around qq. And QQ would correspond to actually diagonal stripes in real space. How am I on time? A couple of minutes, right?
How much time do you need? 5 to 10. Oh, you're fine.
Okay.
5.
A couple of slides. I think it's two free slides. And so what we can do is now we can Fourier transform this back and actually look at what, well, it's not very visible here due to the white being so shiny, but if you transform this back to real space and you look at the staggered, so this is the non-staggered spin susceptibility, and this is the staggered one, you see that actually you're not, at least at these temperatures, we're not really able for bigger system sizes to reproduce the vertical stripes that one finds if you only take a very small system like 16x4. But you do see some domains forming in terms of you have a red here, and if with a bit of imagination you could see blue pieces which are a lot weaker around the red. And finally, one can also look again at the self-energy, and what happens for the self-energy here is quite different with respect to what we had when we started tuning T prime. So here we start from something which is, has some momentum differentiation with the self-energy being larger on the antinode. And then as I increase my U, what I see is that I get a very sharp line forming where this line starts being dominant in terms of the values of the self-energy. You see that the picture is becoming darker. That's only because actually everything is concentrated along this line as you increase U. So one can also look at at the difference between the two lowest frequencies, and you see that this proxy that we had for insulating behavior actually only, I mean, it only happens, the insulating behavior only happens along this line of poles. And so the nature and origin of these lines is something that we're currently still thinking on, of. And the other thing that you can see is that actually your quasi-particle density goes from instead of going from being more like electron-like to hole-like, here it goes from hole-like to electron-like, and in between it passes sort of a phase where it tries to again mimic the nesting nested Fermi surface of the Hall-filled Hubbard model in 2D around here. And you see finally that if you look at the spectral function, again it broadens and it goes from this hole-like shape to more something that is quite broad and quite decoherent but electron-like. Okay, and with that I conclude. So I hope that I have been able to convince you that diagrammatic Monte Carlo is a technique which actually permits you to access regimes which have been previously not accessible for other numerical techniques or analytical techniques. And most importantly, whenever we get convergence series and we can compute results, these results are controllable, and I mean we can give them with numerical error bars, which you know don't have any systematics on top of that. So we have not done any approximation, and you see this gives you a lot of nice results in the Fermi-Hubbard model. And so the obvious next thing, which is what we're doing right now, is to actually combine doping with next nearest neighbor hopping, which will probably yield even more exotic behavior, especially in the self-energy, where we might start seeing some pockets in terms of the Fermi surface. We're also working on D-wave superconductivity within the CDAT formalism. That's something that Hamza Benamestarji, who is sitting in the audience, is currently doing, an intern in our group. Other than that, we have actually applied the diagrammatic Monte Carlo sort of formalism also to the 3D attractive Hubbard model, which is this publication if anyone's interested, and to the triangular lattice at Hall-Filling, in collaboration also with Stuttgart and the Flatiron Institute, and Antoine is also notably part of this project. And what one can also do is take the 3D, I didn't have time to talk about that, but one can take the 3D Hubbard model and start doping that one, which is something that Liam Rampont is actually currently doing in the context of DMFT. And then you can also start looking at more more exotic lattices, such as the Kagome, for example. One could think of doing crossovers between 1, 2, and 3D, or apply the diagrammatic Monte Carlo sort of approach to models with multiple bands, or long range, or add long range interactions, or actually look at spins, which is something which another intern in our group is currently investigating, Raisa Barroso. We've also developed a lot of numerical methodology in terms of doing diagrammatic Monte Carlo in the context of CDAT, so in exponential time, but for all sorts of renormalized schemes, which I didn't have time to talk about, but that sort of gives us a bit of perspective and hope that we'll be able to reach to even lower temperatures and higher interactions. Yeah, and with that, I would like to conclude and thank you for your attention.
Okay, thank you very much, Fedor, for this fantastic overview both of the method and of some recent results. That was really beautiful. Before we take questions, I would like to mention one thing, which is that a lot of this work involves multi-site collaborations, in particular organized through the Simons many-electron collaboration, and it is in this context that Fedor is a postdoc here under the supervision of Michel Ferrero, who is the PI for this Paris side of the Simons Many Electron collaboration. Many of the names here on these slides are involved at one level or another in this multi-site collaboration. So we can now take questions. Any question from the audience? Well, maybe I'll start, but I'm sure, I hope there will be more. Fedor, can you come back to your beautiful multicolored phase diagram with the superfluid phases?
At the weak coupling limit, or
the weak coupling limit? Yes, yes. So this okay. Next one. I prefer. Okay, thank you. So here is my question. So you explained that within this sort of triangular-shaped cone, there is competition with other possible orders, and the convergence of the series is also more problematic. But let me sit outside. But still in the blue x square minus y square region. Okay, so for example here. So here, can you be affirmative, say, in saying that the ground state is really an x square minus y square superconductor?
Yes.
Or okay, you already answered. can we really eliminate the competition with other possible ordering, including those that involve charge order, for example? Because after all, this is done, if I understand correctly, by analyzing the leading eigenvalue from a Bethe-Salpeter equation, right? Calculating the reducible vertex. What about other instabilities? Can you really rule them out?
So, okay, I can say as much that I can rule out in this particular region magnetic instabilities in the sense that sort of the scheme that we have devised is self-consistent. So as long as my eigenvalues are not very big and as long as my series converges, this means that there is no competing instability in the other channel because those diagrams are forcibly included in gamma particle-particle. And so As long as I can get a fully converged series, I can say that yes, that is well. Here's the caveat. I can say that my ground state will be something in the particle channel. Now, you could ask: are there all sorts of more exotic superfluid phases of something plus I something? You know what I refer to. Can I rule out those more complicated sort of instabilities? Those I cannot. One would have to look for them. But at least the magnetic channel, I think we could, yeah. It's
and also the charge channel, charge ordering.
Which would still be particle Hall.
Yes, which would be particle Hall. Absolutely.
Yes, yeah. So it goes under the same umbrella.
Okay, very good. And so what happens within the dangerous cone here?
Yes.
Is that...
Which is, by the way, to some degree arbitrary, because we
I understand.
The points that we... You see, the points where we've actually done calculations, that have been quite costly and done over months in some cases, you see them in these small crosses. So in some cases, for example, here...
Let's not finesse about where the cone really is.
Okay.
There is a more dangerous region, and in this more dangerous region, how do the competing particular instabilities manifest themselves? They manifest themselves in the fact that the series has some more trouble converging, or is that basically the way?
For us, that's how we can... As far as I understand, that's the only way we can see it. What you can do is you can also write down a Bethe-Salpeter equation in the particle Hall channel, and then you can start looking for those instabilities. Of course, the difficulty, and this is something which is not a difficulty for us, but for everyone, is to treat both the particle Hall and particle-particle channel on equal footing. And with approximations, this can be done in terms of the Parquet approximation. But at that point, you have to start throwing away some diagrams in order to be able to actually solve the Parquet equations.
Okay, thank you. Okay, now questions from the audience. Yes, please go ahead.
I have a very naive question. And it's, except for this, when you add this alpha, you use the Barrier interaction. So I was just curious. I mean, you can use, I had in mind, for example, screen interaction. Why don't you mention like this? Do they not exist?
They do exist. We use also, that was actually part of my conclusions, we use also all sorts of renormalized schemes and series, which, I mean, you can also, for example, you can expand what I was showing inside, when you expand inside the magnetic phase, you actually don't start from, say, the paramagnetic bare interaction, so you have to, I mean, in general, yes, there are different ways, there are different series, and we do a lot of that. I didn't want to talk about it because the talk was, I suppose, long and complicated enough as it is. But as a matter of fact, yes, there are ways of doing things.
For example, to elaborate a bit on this question, if you were specifically interested in the low density limit and in the presence of ferromagnetism at large U or absence of ferromagnetism at large U, you would have to dress the interaction with T matrix kind of things.
Exactly.
Right,
so, for example,
study
you can,
that regime.
You can do something which would be starting around the RPA. So you can decide to start around sort of having resummed all of your particle hole bubbles and put them into your interaction, and then design a Feynman diagrammatic series around that. And that's something we have also done, and it works in some cases better, in some cases worse.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, good. Here, go ahead.
How much time does it take to map out the phase diagram in this situation, like computationally expensive?
Okay. that's a good
question.
In particular, with respect to this slide. So it wasn't a big cluster. Let's say, I think the cluster I was running this on is of the order of 1,000 CPUs, which is not a huge cluster, but still reasonable. And I've been computing these things at least for a year, probably more. So it is quite computationally expensive. This one in particular, doing this scheme, because you also have to vary temperature. I mean, this is done with a Bode series, by the way. So here I've actually Bodeified my Green's function, which is not there, but Bode, and I also, so it's my series is in terms of a Bode Green's function and a Bode two-particle Green's function sort of object, which is elongated. And yeah, so this particular one is very costly. Other things, for example, the absolutely latest results that I've been showing at the end, where I do these fixed density sort of bare calculations, there you saw we got all different U's at a particular temperature and particular doping, and that I can get all of that from one computation, from one series, and that one computation would take me maybe a day or two on a couple of hundred CPUs. So that's actually a lot faster.
There was one more question.
Yes,
go ahead.
A bit the same, but can you tell a bit more about, so you said it was done on clusters. Can be these algorithms expand on GPUs rather than CPUs and so on?
I think you're asking the right person, because I'm probably the only person who has ever tried to do this. And yes, it can be done. It's a bit tricky in particular when you're trying to do this. So, you know, the idea with GPUs is that you need to parallelize, meaning all of the threads need to really be independent and be doing exactly the same thing. The problem, for example, when you're trying to do this recursive scheme where you have to you go over all of the subsets of your set, is that that thing is inherently not very parallel. But you can still parallelize it, but it involves some...
Okay, the memory transfer between CPU and GPU will be
That's
not so...
Well, I still, at the end of the day, so this is, I mean, I tried this at the end of my PhD in London, so this is a couple of years ago, and for these were, I think they're called K40s or something, so rather, at this point, old NVIDIA GPU units. I was still able to get, I think, a factor of 50 to 100 with respect to one CPU.
Okay.
But the problem currently is, I think at some point it will be necessary and important to actually think more about how to do all of these things on GPUs. But right now, let's say the availability of CPUs that we have on all sorts of clusters in all sorts of departments really outweighs the availability and number of GPUs. So I think once this balance changes, people will be thinking about it a lot more, and some people are thinking about it already, but currently everything we run is on CPUs.
More questions? Okay, let's give another round of applause to Fedor. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.